Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, May 30th, 2017. The Vatican says Pope Francis will not be coming to South Sudan as originally planned.
Today, Tuesday, the director of the Holy See Press Office, Greg Burke, told journalists at the Vatican that the trip that had been planned to South Sudan by Pope Francis will not take place this year in 2017.
And a South Sudanese military court begins trying the case against soldiers charged with murder and rape.
It's a great step, it's a great gesture, because this case has been on for the last almost a year, and the whole world has been waiting for it. The start today gives us a green light that there is hope for justice at some stage. Of course, it gives us a primary basis of what follows next.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A journalist with the National Catholic Reporter has confirmed that the Vatican has postponed a trip by Pope Francis to South Sudan planned for October this year. Joshua McLeary says Vatican spokesperson Craig Burke did not give a reason for cancelling the papal visit. McLeary says security concerns could be the reasons for the change in Pope Francis' plan to visit South Sudan, along with Justin Welby, the Archbishop of the Canterbury and the head of the Anglican Church.
All we know is that today, Tuesday, the director of the Holy See Press Office, Greg Burke, told journalists at the Vatican that the trip that had been planned to South Sudan by Pope Francis will not take place this year in 2017. We know that the Vatican had been looking at a trip and that Pope Francis really wanted to come to the country alongside the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. We don't know specifically why the trip is not possible. At this time, the spokesperson did not give us a specific reason, but it appears that they were having trouble making sure that the security considerations were secure enough for the Pope's visit.
Yes. And did they set any date later or next year?
No. Greg Burke today at the Vatican didn't give us a date of when it might be possible. He just said it wouldn't be taking place this year. So we're wondering if that might mean it could still be possible in 2018. I think some of it might depend on the weather considerations, the best season for a visit, and I don't know when it might be possible next.
And in your report, you mentioned about a visit by a team from Vatican to assess the situation in South Sudan. Did the Vatican press person speak about what that team found out in South Sudan?
No. I knew of that visit because we had had my publication, National Catholic Reporter, had a reporter in South Sudan earlier this month on a different story, working with some of the Catholic sisters in South Sudan who are doing ministry, and the sisters had told him that there were some Vatican officials there investigating the possibility of a visit. That's pretty normal. Whenever the Pope is looking at making a visit, the Vatican sends people. I mean, the visits of the Pope are very structured, and so they have to look at kind of every moment of a visit, what would be possible, what the situation would be like, and so it's pretty normal that the Vatican would send those officials to investigate the possibility.
You've been covering the Vatican. How would you rate their response to issues on South Sudan? Is South Sudan high on the agenda of Vatican?
Well, it seems to me that the Pope has expressed worry and concern about South Sudan a number of times. I think he really wanted to come to the country in a sign of peace. It seemed very extraordinary, his idea to make a visit alongside the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury. That would be the first time in history that the Pope and the Anglican Archbishop had traveled together. It would be very historic. And so it seems that it's very high on the Pope's mind and that it's very important to him to make the visit and that he's going to, I think, keep trying to find a way to make it happen.
I remember when he went to Central African Republic before the trip, there were concerns about security, but he
made the trip. Is there really particular security concern in South Sudan that made him to postpone his trip?
I don't know exactly what the particular concern from the Vatican was. I was with the Pope in the Central African Republic. It seemed like a bit of a dangerous situation, but there had been an atmosphere of peace for several months before the Pope's visit. It appeared that although there was a temporary government, that it had a good sense of control of the situation. And then also the Pope's security was really helped in that matter by the presence of all the UN officials and all the UN soldiers who really cleared the path and made sure that everything was safe. And so I don't know if the South Sudan right now has that same atmosphere, or if they're looking for a bit more of an atmosphere of security before they can go ahead.
That was Joshua MacLeod, the Vatican correspondent with the Rome-based National Catholic Reporter. He was speaking with me from Rome earlier today. A military court in South Sudan today began its trial against soldiers accused of murder and raping aid workers. 13 of the 20 suspects appeared in court for their first hearing. The charges include murder, rape, torture, and looting during the attack on the Terrain Hotel in Juba last July. The chief military prosecutor says the accused could face death penalty for rape if found guilty. Waki Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Presiding Judge Brigadier General Knight Bruni delivers his opening remarks at the start of the trial at the SPLA Military Court at the Gieda Barracks in Juba. The 13 suspects, all dressed in uniforms of the various units of the South Sudan Army, were driven to the court amid tight security. Four of the suspects were dressed in the uniform of the Tiger Brigade, which got the president. Lieutenant General Mangar Buong, Assistant Chief of Defense Forces for Administration, Finance and Personnel, says the trial proves the army does not condone human rights abuses. Chief Military Prosecutor Colonel Abubakar Mohammed Ramadan asked Michael Woodward, the manager of Terrain Hotel, to describe what happened on July 11th. Woodward testified between 50 and 100 armed soldiers backed by a Land Cruiser mounted with a machine gun entered the premises after they overpowered security guards and broke through the gates of the hotel. Woodward said the soldiers began beating up people.
At 4 p.m., soldiers began to break into the residential building. They began looting and vandalizing and shooting through the doors and windows. During this time, another group began to steal the vehicles. A total of 18 were stolen, including 9 belonging to Terrain Services. Between 4:30 onwards, physical attacks on the people inside the new block and the apartment began. This includes the murder of one man named John Gatlowak, working for the international NGO Ingenue. The gang rape of at least 5 international women working for international organizations.
The prosecution presented documentary evidence, but Judge Bruni adjourned the court after about an hour and a half when the prosecutor failed to present a charge sheet at the hearing. Speaking outside the court, prosecutor Phillips Anyang told South Sudan in Focus the trial is a step forward in the fight against impunity in South Sudan.
It's a great step. It's a great gesture because this case has been on for the last almost a year. And the whole world has been waiting for it. The start today gives us a green light that there is hope for justice at some stage. Of course, it gives us a primary basis of what follows next.
According to a Human Rights Watch report, female aid workers were threatened at gunpoint at the hotel and raped all while UNMISS peacekeepers stationed just 1.2 kilometers away failed to respond to rescue calls. It is the first time the SPLA is trying its soldiers on charges of rape. First Lieutenant Peter Malwala Deng, the defense lawyer of the 13 suspects, says he is satisfied with today's proceedings.
Actually, we start, but in the middle of the session, I have given a chance in order to cross-examine the prosecution. Actually, I asked him, but he is not able to answer all my questions. So I pray to Honorable Court in order to adjourn the case to the 6th of coming March in order to prepare himself well.
Last October, the army said it arrested over 70 soldiers suspected of committing various crimes in July, but it has yet to sentence any suspect connected to the outbreak of violence in the capital, claiming there is lack of evidence. The soldiers charged with rape could be sentenced to death if found guilty. The next court hearing is scheduled to take place in June 6. Waki Simon Wudu prepared this report from Juba. Some South Sudanese analysts are not convinced today's military trials will mark an end to impunity for crimes allegedly committed by soldiers. One researcher says prosecutors overlooked a number of key factors and consequently tarnished any faith in citizens have in seeing justice in South Sudan. Ian Bior has more for VOA from Washington.
While some have praised the trial as a step toward ending the cycle of impunity, others, including Amnesty International researcher Elizabeth Deng, point to what she calls crucial flaws in today's proceedings.
First, we oppose the use of military courts for crimes against civilians. And in fact, the SPLA Act itself provides that, quote, whenever military personnel commits an offense against a civilian or civilian property, the civil court shall assume jurisdiction over such an offense.
Deng does not think the trial is an adequate step toward accountability. For one thing, she says, the venue of the proceedings in Juba's military barracks could foster an atmosphere of intimidation.
You know, for people who have lived in Juba, they know that this is where the violence in December 2015 broke out, that Giada is notorious as a place of detention and forced disappearance and torture, and that there are, you know, that it's a place that's filled with military personnel. So when you have the alleged perpetrators who are members of the military themselves, it's extremely unlikely that victims or witnesses would feel comfortable and safe participating in, attending, giving testimony to a trial that takes place within a military barracks.
The trials also pose a logistical challenge. As Deng points out, many of the foreign victims are not in South Sudan.
And it will take, you know, a special commitment and effort to contact them and to ensure their availability, whether by scheduling for them to come to South Sudan or allowing them to testify but by video link. So I think, you know, this will require a prosecution that's really committed and diligent.
Other observers like Remember Mia Mingi, co-founder of the newly created South Sudan Human Rights Observatory, an organization of volunteer South Sudanese investigators, says the army has a history of not taking rape accusations seriously. Mia Mingi says what is required is an international investigative mechanism to carry out nationwide investigations of sexual violence in South Sudan.
The fate of the Ivory Coast depends on the fate of the peace agreement. And as we speak at the moment, we do not know if the peace agreement is dead, is wounded, is finished, is collapsed, is being implemented. We don't know. Victims of injustice and impunity in South Sudan can no longer afford to wait for a mechanism that depends on a peace agreement that's not being implemented. And so the peace agreement cannot take the hope of justice.
Mia Mingi says the international community should not wait for the establishment of the hybrid court, as stipulated in the 2015 peace deal, to act. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Two major Kenyan banks operating in South Sudan are shutting down more than a dozen of their branches across the country. Kenya Commercial Bank and Equity Bank say they are closing some of their branches because of insecurity and hyperinflation, which have made it hard for them to make profit in South Sudan. An economic analyst says the closures will have negative consequences for dozens of families across South Sudan. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
Kenya Commercial Bank is the largest foreign bank in South Sudan, with about 20 branches across the country. When the war broke out in late 2013, the Kenyan bank closed four branches in the Greater Upper Nile region and has since closed two more branches in Juba, one in Biltham and the other in Muniki. Nicola Choge is the head of corporate banking at KCB Bank. He says Today, the bank is shutting down 5 more branches due to insecurity.
We have had challenges logistically in accessing some of those branches. These branches are mainly in upcountry, and they are specifically Yambio, Rumbek, Kwajok, and Torit. We also closed one branch in Juba by the name Konyo Konyo.
Choge says, because of hyperinflation and the continued fall in the value of the South Sudan pound, KCB will have to reduce its operations, but he calls it a temporary shutdown.
We are bound to change our business model. We say let's temporarily close those branches. We more or less go into hibernation mode. The day the economy picks up, which we are optimistic, we will reopen those branches.
Equity Bank is also closing branches. The bank's executive director, Addis Ababa Akongdit, says Equity is shutting down 7 of its 12 branches in South Sudan, mainly in Greater Equatoria.
The branches that were closed is Torit, Yei, Kajakeji, Yambio, SSPL, and Bilpom. The reason why we closed those branches is purely a business decision. It become very unsustainable in terms of cost to manage the operations of those branches outside Juba.
Akongdit says it was also difficult sending cash to those branches. He says many customers crossed into neighboring countries, deserting their accounts.
You take an example of a place like Torit or Yambio, where we had no enough customers to be able to generate enough income to cover for those costs.
James Alich, professor of economics at South Sudan's Upper Nile University, says dozens of families are bound to lose their livelihoods with the closing of the KCB and Equity Bank branches. Alich says it also hurts South Sudan's economy in general.
At the macro level, these branches, both KCB and Equity, were paying revenues to the government. Now there's going to be a revenue loss, and now the result, even if it is £1, that £1 is not going to flow to the Ministry of Finance Treasury. You could also look at this from the perspective of economic growth, that this employment were contributing to the growth of the domestic product.
Alich says the government should beef up security in the areas of the bank branches so that citizens do not leave the country.
The government should try to sit down with them and find a way how they could be helped. One way could be security. So upgrading security in those areas would be one way, or even telling the people that your government is here to protect you. So those of you in Yambio, those of you in other places, please do not leave your place.
The managing directors of KCB and Equity Bank in South Sudan both say they have no plans to completely pull out of the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Viajo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at returning refugees. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you define a successful life?
I would describe a successful person in life as somebody who has a job, who is doing well in his job, taking good care of the family, and the person is happy in life.
A successful life is when you know what your mission is or you are accomplishing it. It brings fulfillment, satisfaction.
It's not about what you have or what you own, but you being comfortable and happy and fulfilled.
Well, to me, a successful life is a life where you wake up in the morning and achieve your goals, where you provide all the needs that you want in life, you help the people you want to, and be known as well, be famous.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about high-tech methods for predicting hunger in countries. Computer algorithms power much of modern life and can also help and malnutrition and hunger in Africa, according to the International Center for Tropical Agriculture. Lenin Rubaga has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
The International Center for Tropical Agriculture has spent the past 4 years developing the Nutrition Early Warning System, or NEWS. The goal is to catch the subtle signs of a hunger crisis brewing in Africa as much as a year in advance. SIAT says the system uses machine learning. As more information is fed into the system, the algorithms will get better at identifying patterns and trends. The system will get smarter. Information technology expert Andy Jarvis leads the project.
The cutting edge side of this is really about bringing in streams of information from multiple sources and making sense of it. But it's a huge volume of information. The novelty is then you making sense of that using things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, and condensing it into simple messages.
Other nutrition surveillance systems exist, like FuseNet, the Famine Early Warning System Network, which was created in the mid-1980s. But SIAT says NEWS will be able to draw insight from a massive amount of diverse data, enabling it to identify hunger risks faster than traditional methods. Dr. Masi Lungaho is a SIAT nutrition expert.
What is different about NEWS is that it pays attention to malnutrition, not just drought or famine, but the nutrition outcome that really matters, malnutrition, especially in women and children. For the first time, we're saying these are the options, way ahead of time. That gives policymakers an opportunity to really do what they intend to do, which is make the lives of women and children better in Africa.
While food emergencies like famine and drought grab headlines, the International Center for Tropical Agriculture says chronic malnutrition affects 1 in 4 people in Africa, taking a serious toll on economic growth and leaving them especially vulnerable in times of crisis. Senior Policy Officer Olufunso Somerin is with the Africa Development Bank.
In 2030, 13 years from now, Africa is going to have 200 million children below the age of 5. Now, once a child is stunted or misses a level of nourishment at that age, it affects that child psychologically, economically, socially. So a stunted child in future is actually a stunted economy. So linking issues of nutrition at individual level to Africa's development and transformation on a broader scale is important.
SIAT says African governments will be able to access NEWS via nutrition dashboards, where they can get risk assessments, alerts, and recommendations. The system is expected to become operational in 4 African countries, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Nigeria, by year's end. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Hundreds of South Sudanese who fled to Uganda are voluntarily returning to their homes in Lanya County of Yei River State. Thousands of their families fled Lanya when fighting broke out between government forces and rebels last year. The returnees say they left the camp to escape hunger after the UN Refugee Agency had to cut food ration. Daniel Friday Martin has more for VOA from Yei.
The latest wave of exhausted-looking returning refugees arrived on Monday. Speaking in Arabic, Lanya County Commissioner Ernesto Taban says relief officials registered thousands of people, mostly women and children, who returned voluntarily.
Population, the national is roughly more than 5,000.
The population of returnees has increased to more than 5,000. There are women and children in my presence, very tired and hungry without food. I am requesting for assistance in terms of food, medicine, farm tools, seeds to be delivered to these people.
The returnees say they walked 4 to 5 days. Some others rode bicycles. Returnee Stephen Lujang says he left Rhino Camp in Uganda's Arua district last week because of deteriorating living conditions. Speaking in Arabic, Lujang says refugees have limited access to basic social services, including health care and education.
the food ratio, which we used to receive at an average of 12 kilograms, has been cut down to 6 kilograms per person. When women go to the forest to collect firewood, they are harassed and sent away by Maset, wilding youth. Life has become difficult.
Lojang also says the relationship between the refugees and the host communities has deteriorated as both communities struggle to survive on the available resources. Returnee Victoria Asa says she left Bidibidi settlement camp because the area did not have clean drinking water. Speaking Arabic, the mother of five says she also left because there was no school in the camp for her children.
We were unhappy at the camp partly because there was no water. There were no water tanks that ferried water for the refugees, but sometimes they fail to deliver water to us. I have some children and I am not able to register them in schools because the schools there demands us to pay some tuition fees, which I did not have.
Asa says both the government and armed opposition must end the fighting so some Sudanese women and children can return to live in their villages. Returnee Philip Tabule says in Arabic that he too left the Bidibidi refugee settlement camp to escape the harsh conditions.
We walked while others rode bicycles. We were more than 70 who started our journey, and more are still coming behind us. What we want is for the government to help us with some food to eat, because when we left this place, our houses were burnt and all properties looted, and we have nothing.
County Commissioner Taban is calling on the national government and the armed opposition forces to end the fighting and to protect the civil population in Lanya. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the music Komwawo by Emily Mukwasa from Uganda. We have been listening to Muli Namukasa with the song Komao. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.